This is VOA News via remote. I'm Tommy McNeil. Globally, more than 346,000 people have died from COVID-19, and there are approximately 5.5 million confirmed infections. In the U.S., more than 98,000 people have died from the virus, and there are more than 1.6 million confirmed infections. Americans settled for small processions and online tributes instead of parades Monday, as they observed Memorial Day in the shadow of the pandemic, which forced communities to honor the nation's military dead with modest, more subdued ceremonies that also remembered those lost to the coronavirus. On the weekend that marked the unofficial start of summer, authorities warned people heading to beaches, parks, or backyard barbecues to heed social distancing rules to avoid a resurgence of the disease. President Donald Trump honored America's war dead Monday in back-to-back Memorial Day appearances colored by an epic struggle off the battlefield against the coronavirus. Eager to demonstrate national revival from the pandemic, Mr. Trump doubled up on his public schedule while threatening to pull the Republican National Convention out of Charlotte in August unless North Carolina's Democratic governor gives a quick green light to the party's plans to assemble en masse. The U.S. death toll from the pandemic approached 100,000. North Carolina, 2 days earlier, reported its largest daily increase yet in COVID-19 sickness. Mr. Trump first honored the nation's fallen at Arlington National Cemetery. The Japanese government is declaring a success for what it's called the Japan model in controlling its coronavirus outbreak. It never imposed a strict lockdown seen in other countries, emphasizing voluntary efforts. And on Monday, Prime Minister Shinzo Abe lifted the state of emergency set in Tokyo and four other areas, the last regions under the measures. Japan has comparatively fewer deaths compared to many other major countries. This is VOA News. Two of Europe's hottest vacation destinations made some major steps toward getting those tourists back on Monday. The Spanish government says it's going to allow international flights within a two-week quarantine starting on July 1st. Greece, too, is also calling out for vacationers and their money. On Monday, it opened up the Greek Isles again to travel, as well as allowing cafes and restaurants to reopen as part of the gradual lifting of restrictions. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson on Monday laid out a roadmap for a gradual reopening for thousands of high street shops, department stores, and shopping centers starting next month, a day after announcing some young students may begin returning to school June 1st. Johnson made the comments about a retail to give businesses time to prepare and make the necessary adjustments. Johnson, who had fallen ill with the coronavirus himself, said the change would be contingent against five benchmark measures and would only be permitted for stores that are able to meet the COVID-19 secure guidelines. Numerous scandals over lockdown rules and the elite that have followed but consumed British politics does not look like it will take down Prime Minister Johnson's top aide. Dominic Cummings, a Brexit architect, says he does not regret his decision to drive 250 miles from London to his parents' property, nor will he resign, nor does it flout the restrictions that have gripped the population. Cummings says that he made the journey as there were no reasonable child care options in London if both he and his wife were seriously ill. But at the time, Cummings' wife was already ill with COVID-19 symptoms, and he himself became ill during the drive. Johnson backs Cummings, yet many believe that it was hypocritical given the government's mantra at the time to avoid such movements. Cummings is the latest in a number of high-profile people who have drawn ire over similar accusations in the UK from politicians to professional athletes. Hong Kong leader Carrie Lam on Tuesday added to a raft of attempts by local and Beijing officials to provide reassurance that proposed national security laws would not trample on the city's rights and freedoms. This is amid widespread concerns. Lam said those officials concerned need to wait for the details of the proposed legislation. Comments came after Beijing unveiled plans last week for national security legislation for Hong Kong that aimed to tackle secession, subversion, and terrorist activities and could see Chinese intelligence agencies set up bases within the city. You can find more at voanews.com. Via remote, I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, May 26th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Burundi's ruling party wins last week's presidential election, but the opposition is alleging fraud.
The majority of the Burundian people are not really quite surprised by what the Independent Electoral Commission has just announced. Those who support the opposition say that they cannot accept the result of this election.
Liberia's four-party opposition collaboration says it will not accept a delay in this year's midterm election beyond December. A teachers' group says it will challenge, in quote, the South African government's decision to reopen schools on June 1st. Malawi students get school meals at home, and Zimbabwe university students are concerned about e-learning.
The moment a specific mode of learning only suits a minority, then it becomes a privilege, not a right. So introducing things like e-learning that are not suitable for the majority, it means that e-learning has automatically become a privilege.
Abiona Matarayika is the president of University of Zimbabwe Student Representative Council, and truck drivers are frustrated with Botswana's COVID-19 testing at the border. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Opposition and civil society groups in Burundi say they are displeased with the outcome of the general election because of allegations of voter irregularities and fraud. They also say intimidation, harassment, arrest, and violence carried out by supporters of the ruling party ahead of the polls undermined the integrity of the election. Their remarks come after the Electoral Commission announced that the governing CNDD-FDD party candidate won the presidential poll with 68% of the vote. May opposition leader Agathon Rwasa from the CNL party garnered 24% of the vote. He has rejected the outcome, saying the party's own tabulation show he won the election. Pierre Emmanuel of Iwaku tells viewers Peter Clotty that the planned installation of the president-elect is unlikely to be interrupted by opposition and civil society groups.
Well, the majority of the Burundian people in the country, some of them are not really quite surprised by what the Independent Electoral Commission has just announced, just because it's like the majority were saying, how come the ruling party would accept to lose such an election? And other people on the other side, those who support change, those who support the opposition say that and have been saying that they cannot in any way accept the results of these elections, saying that they have been rigged before, and they give different reasons, as you might have heard, saying that some of the observers were not allowed to do their work and only were favored those from the ruling party. So, and they keep reporting different cases of electoral fraud in different parts of the country. And these make it impossible for them to believe the results of that election. But on the other side of the ruling party is just jubilation. Everybody's happy.
Now, Pierre, do you anticipate the opposition party challenging the outcome of the elections in court?
Exactly. And from as you might have maybe followed, the chief or the leader of the ruling of the opposition party CNL, the National Congress for Liberty, has already said that he would not accept in any way the results of the election. So therefore, you can understand what we expect now is that he just filed a complaint to the Constitutional Court, and probably hoping that it will not be biased and shall decide in his favor. But who knows what is going to happen? It's still a question. But so far, Agathon Rwasa has not said anything. But what we know is that he is highly unlikely to accept the results of this election.
But a lot of people have questioned the independence of the judiciary. And looking at the results that have come out so far released by the Independent Electoral Commission, or CNE, do you think that he could be successful if he goes to court to have this election thrown out, or the outcome you know, ruled in his favor?
Well, this is actually a very big question, and he will be the one to respond to this question. But given how the judiciary is built, is constructed, so many people have this opinion that it is it's biased and it's only working in the favor of the ruling party. So I don't think if ever it's like that, it is going to help him, is going to really make a decision or a verdict in the favor of Agathon Rwasa, the leader of the opposition party.
What has been the reaction of Burundians across board about the credibility of the outcome of these elections?
Well, the majority of the people, if you try to listen from here and there, is that it has not been this kind of very transparent. It was not peaceful. So they said a wide range of things that could make it impossible for all the people to believe the results of these elections. So I had told you earlier how those elections were organized. First of all, the majority of the people, all the people could see, when you see the people, the members of the opposition party being persecuted all over the country, and when you see the observers being imprisoned according to different reports, even one was killed according to another report, and when you combine all those things, it's very easy to see that none of the opposition party or from maybe the civil society organizations not really taking any stance would accept that the elections were peacefully organized.
That was Pierre Emmanuel of Iwaku speaking with viewers Peter Clotet from Bujumbura, Burundi. In Liberia, the leader of the newly formed opposition collaborating political party says the group will not accept postponing the country's midterm election past December this year. According to the constitution, the elections are scheduled to take place in mid-October this year. However, President George Weah has asked the legislature to postpone the vote after he said the National Elections Commission had informed him it was lagging behind in preparing for the poll due to the coronavirus pandemic. Alexander Cummings, who was recently chosen as the new opposition leader, says the opposition would accept some delay, but not beyond December 2020. Cummings also outlines some of the objectives of the new collaboration.
There are four key areas we need to focus on immediately. One is to set up a functioning CPP. That means get the CPP recognized and certified by the National Elections Commission, get the secretariat fully functioning and with all the right systems and processes to run. Make sure we're connecting the county organizations, make sure we're connecting with the diaspora, make sure we're connecting with regional international players, and also setting up our communications infrastructure. Next priority is to begin to consolidate the opposition, both political parties and others. All actors who are concerned about the direction of our country are interested in replacing the current government. We want to reconcile, integrate, and bring that group together. Then we want to develop a vision, a mission, a manifesto. What are we for as the CPP? What are we advocating to our people? What contract are we committing to with them? And so we need to develop that. Of course, we also want to win most of the upcoming seats in the by-elections.
Having covered Liberia over the years, I can say that this is not the first time that the opposition political parties have endeavored to come together. But too often, such cooperation tended to fall by the wayside. What do you think makes this coalition different from previous ones?
By the way, we are not in a coalition yet. We are in a collaboration. The goal is to move towards a grand coalition. But we want to take baby steps. We want to build trust. We want to build processes and systems as a means of ensuring that when we go from a collaboration to a coalition, it will endure, it will last. We are all very clear that Liberians want us to work together, that whoever is seen as causing this collaboration to break up will be punished electorally. And we also believe that in strength, in numbers, our chances of replacing this government increases.
The midterm legislative elections are supposed to be in October this year, but the president, or President George Weah, has asked the legislature to postpone the election, I think because of the coronavirus pandemic. What is your comment?
It's something that is not acceptable to the CPP. Look, it may be appropriate to delay till December, because of the coronavirus. But beyond that, we will push back significantly. We'll work with the legislature to make sure that doesn't happen.
There is a clause in the agreement that brought the four opposition parties together. That clause states that only new, active, and visible members of the county shall be recommended by the parties for local government positions. The ruling coalition, President George Weah's ruling coalition, is criticizing you or accusing you of hypocrisy. Your comment.
James, you have to read the entire section. If you just take one article, you will get the impression and a misrepresentation that people are attributing to. But we accept all the feedback. That section needs some work, needs to be revisited, and we will do that.
Alexander Cummings is the leader of the newly formed opposition collaborating political parties of Liberia. He was speaking with us from the capital, Monrovia. In South Africa, the Education Union says it wants the government to review plans to reopen schools on June 1st. The group's remarks come after the government eased restrictions meant to halt the spread of the coronavirus. The administration also announced plans to reopen schools on June 1st, starting with grades 7 and 12. But the Educators Union says the administration has yet to provide adequate personal protection equipment for teachers and students. Sipiwe Mpongose, the General Secretary of the Teachers Union, tells VOA's Peter Clotty that his group plans to challenge the government's decision to reopen schools in court.
We are saying that because we have done our own check of schools, and so far we see that the government has been lying to the public, because there are so many schools that have vandalized during this lockdown period and they are not fixed. And the government has failed to produce a list of educators and non-teaching staff in schools with comorbidities. So we believe that even the PPEs that they are claiming to say they've delivered to schools, they are not there. So we believe this must be the matter for the courts to decide, because the government is lying to us.
So if the government goes ahead with the plans to open schools beginning June 1, what will be your action since you want the government to halt it and the government wants to go ahead with those plans to open schools?
We are confident that the court will uphold our position, given the evidence that we have. We still have confidence in the court of this land. So if then comes to a push that the courts are delayed, because our application is on urgent basis, we will be having 15 members in each province picketing outside government legislature.
So
until they hear.
Are you engaging the government to resolve this impasse?
Yes, we are trying to engage them, but they are so unreasonable. The minister is so arrogant, she don't want to engage with us because we are not allowing her space to continue to lie.
Well, but there's a policy decision that is going to be made. Some people are saying it will be unfortunate that you will call the government lying. You might disagree on policy, but calling them lies are quite regrettable. So what do you plan to do, since you said the government appears to be intransigent? Are your lawyers looking at it or taking to the court? And when do you plan on taking this matter to court?
As of the past weekend, our legal team are at work 24/7. Any day we'll be serving the court's papers to the Department of Education, to the presidency, and any other ministry or department that is also involved in pushing parents to release kids to go and fight an invisible enemy.
So what should parents expect from you, looking at the situation on the ground? Because the government seems to want to go ahead to open schools. Students need to study. Some are suggesting that your so-called intransigent or strong opposition to the government plans will undermine efforts for students to learn and be equipped for the future.
We are saying the curriculum need to be changed. We are saying the lives of our teachers and learners comes first. We are saying our experts, health experts, as well as those of the United Nations, the World Health Organization, have said that the virus in winter spreads faster. So we can't open in the midst of winter, knowing very well what has happened in Europe and in America. We can't risk that. Any reasonable, rational person must know.
Sipiwe Umpongotsi is the General Secretary of the Teachers Union of South Africa. He was speaking with VOA's Peter Clotty. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voices of America. I'm James Butte in Washington today. It's Tuesday, May 26. Universities in Zimbabwe are expected to reopen next week, Monday, June 1st, under World Health Organization coronavirus guidelines. However, the Minister for Higher and Tertiary Education, Amon Monwira, says only final year students will be allowed on campus. He told the Zimbabwe Herald newspaper on Monday that the rest of the students will do their classes online. However, the students are protesting and threatening court action over e-learning. They say they don't have laptops, smartphones, and unlimited internet access. Abiona Matarangika is the president of University of Zimbabwe Student Representative Council. She says the students are not against e-learning per se, but that they are concerned about the lack of adequate infrastructure and policy to kickstart the program.
From the look of things in the surveys that we have had, it has shown and proven that a lot of students will not be able to learn using the internet, using computers, because they totally do not have computers, and data is very expensive these days. And in Zimbabwe, you know, buying data is a form of luxury.
As you know, the coronavirus lockdown has disrupted normal learning. How do you expect students to continue their learning unless they resort to e-learning?
Oh, yes. Coronavirus has become a global pandemic and we cannot actually pin it on anyone. However, I think people actually take this whole idea of us protesting against e-learning from a perspective that we generally do not want to learn, but then that is not the case. The issue and the story in question is, are we at a position as a country to facilitate things like e-learning? The students cannot afford, some do not even have computers too, some cannot even afford buy data. As you know, data prices are always hiking after every fortnight or a week or whatever. And some families are actually finding it very hard to even provide for a meal a day. And you tell them that we have introduced e-learning. And buying data bundle is actually a luxury. So in as much as we would want to resort to e-learning because we want to make progress, we also have to look at the fact that will the students be able to concentrate with their schoolwork? Will they be able to afford data? These are the issues that really need to be worked on. Unless the government provides computers, unless the government provides students with free data, then we can start negotiating.
Part of your argument is that e-learning violates the students' right to education. How so?
Our constitution clearly states that education is not a privilege, rather it is a right. And then the moment a specific mode of learning only suits a minority, then it becomes a privilege, not a right. That's where we are coming from. So introducing things like e-learning that are not suitable for the majority, it means that e-learning has automatically become a privilege. That's where we feel our rights have been violated.
You have gone to court, I understand. What kind of result are you expecting from the court?
We have not gone to court. We only made threats that we would go to court if the institution was not willing to adjust some of the things for the students. However, so far, so good in courts. The university has agreed to come to a table where we discuss facts and things that need to be changed, hoping that we will get better results tomorrow because the meeting is tomorrow.
Abiona Matarangika is the president of University of Zimbabwe Student Representative Council. She was speaking with us from the capital, Harare. Elementary school children in Malawi, one of Africa's poorest countries, normally get free meals at school. But when the coronavirus pandemic forced schools to close in March, families were left with the added cost burden. The international charity Mary's Meals, which runs the feeding program in one-third of Malawi's elementary schools, has started distributing food to poor communities to help them cope. Lamek Masina reports from Blantyre.
Mary's Meals has been feeding thousands of children in the schools for the past 18 years. The young learners receive wheat porridge made from maize or soybean flour mixed with salt and sugar. The aim is to increase enrollment for children who might fail to attend classes because of hunger in their families and to meet the nutrition needs of the students. Bert Rombert is the country director for Mary's Meals in Malawi. He spoke to VOA by telephone.
We normally work in around 1,000 under 6 in primary schools in Malawi, and we have a focus on some special schools, children who are suffering from HIV/AIDS, and also disabled children. So those children received special attention, let's say in total about 940, so approximately 1 million children in Malawi are covered by this action.
The closure of schools in March because of COVID-19, the disease caused by the coronavirus, deprived students of this source of nutrition, posing a threat to their health. Rombert says this has forced the charity to find new ways of feeding the children in compliance with COVID-19 preventive measures.
We decided to make ready-made food packages that the parents could collect at the schools and take home. We wanted to limit the interactions between human beings and at the same time make sure that the individual child received their nutritious meal.
Lisnet Kanamule says her two children are benefiting from the school feeding program. She told VOA via telephone that although the meals are meant for her children, the whole family is benefiting. She says this is helping us a lot, and because of this pandemic, things are not working. We are facing food shortages in our homes. So as a family, the foodstuffs we are receiving for our children are helping us because we are cooking porridge to cater for the whole family. Rombert says the new program is expected to run through July when the Malawian school year normally ends. He says prospects are high the initiative will resume should the schools remain closed at the start of the new school year in September. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blantyre.
Botswana's strict COVID-19 border checks have riled truck drivers who say they spent days waiting to be cleared. Botswana has so far confirmed only 35 COVID-19 cases and one death, but began requiring the border testing amid rising concerns about imported infections. Kumdusi Dube reports from Habaruni.
Truck drivers are growing frustrated with long delays at Botswana's borders due to required COVID-19 testing. The truckers say they wait for up to 5 days before being cleared to deliver goods in Botswana or transit through the country. Zambian truck driver Amon Piri complains there are no washing facilities at the border checkpost and they run out of food while waiting for results.
We are frustrated with the situation going on. We've been kept in Botswana since we crossed from Zambia for about 5 days now. No results. And we are all truck drivers gathered in one place, about 100 trucks. And we are being kept here with a single toilet, no water, no food. We are only using the bush as a core of nature.
Piri urged Botswana authorities to speed up the testing.
They told us results are going to be out in 72 hours, but up to now, nothing has come out. We are appealing to the authorities to take action now.
South African truck driver Malusi Dlamini says the delays have led to tensions across the border in South Africa. He says some South African truckers are threatening to block trucks entering from Botswana if the situation is not resolved.
It's a frustrating situation. We hope that it will be addressed soon before tensions boil over. There are long queues of up to 10 kilometers of trucks waiting to be cleared.
Botswana truck drivers are also subjected to COVID-19 tests when they re-enter the country. Mqondisi Dube for VOA News, Gaborone.
And that's it for this Tuesday, May 26th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm James Barton in Washington, wishing you a very good day.